You got it?
You got it.
I'd like to go ahead and call this session to order. This is our scheduled board discussion session, today, September 8th, 2015. Dr. Riddell, do you have anything before we start, or are we just going to start in with board members?
No, sir, if we can just go down the list.
All right, Mr. Searcy?
The thing that I had, Mr. Chairman, was the legislative agenda. You have everybody was given a copy of it and for their review. If you have anything to add or take away from it, this is what's going to be presented. And I think that the best, I've never presented to the legislative group before, so I'm not sure that this whole thing just needs to be read. I would be willing to listen to suggestions, anybody. But this is what's going to be presented. It's going to be given to them in advance. And if we have anything we really want to hammer down on, I'm willing to listen.
Yeah.
2%. 2%.
Yeah.
What was 2%? Oh,
2%.
2%.
2%. I'm sorry, I couldn't hear.
Southern. Get it
just a question. Everything I think is fine. I went through the whole thing. There was an issue I had on page 2 where it says immediately remove the Florida standards assessment and replace it with a set of national non-reference tests, norm reference tests. We suggest the IO assessment for grade 3 through 8 and the PSAT for grade 9 and the SAT for grade 10. This district tests the PSAT in grade 10.
Correct.
And so, and let me say, from my experience, only personal experience, from what I understand, a young student taking the PSAT in 10th even will historically do better in the SAT, hopefully, without any studying, just because of the maturity to 11th grade. So if we start by this, I'm not comfortable with asking to take the PSAT in 9th grade where the student's not as mature, and also we don't do that in this district. So I don't know, I don't think we should have it on our legislative agenda.
So the reason it's in there is that mirrors the Seminole solution. That is exactly how they crafted their suggestion, that we use the Iowa assessment for grades 3 through 8 and the PSAT for grade 9, SAT
Dale,
for grade 10.
Would you rather have it say something like either take out the suggested ones or norm reference test, comma, such as
correct,
the Iowa assessment and PSAT and SAT?
Well, that would be fine. I just was curious how the superintendent felt because we're lobbying for something that we don't do, and then we would be putting the tests up a year early. I don't know what other test you would use, but I wasn't comfortable with that. To say let's lobby that and would be counterproductive.
Yeah,
to Dr. Riddell.
I believe the reason that
or our kids,
that the solution is set up that way is we're supposed to measure math and reading grades 3 through 10, so there has to be a 9th grade test and there has to be a 10th grade test.
Right.
So, Seminole, when they crafted their solution, they thought 9th grade PSAT, 10th grade SAT.
Sean, you had something?
I did. And Palm Beach County just said the same thing. They just sent a letter saying that they're just going to do the PSAT and the SAT, and that's what they're going to use the concordance for, because that's already actually in statute. So this is in keeping with what other districts on the state
at that
are
grade
looking
level?
At. I'm not sure.
That's the only thing.
But
we
can easily reword that to say such as the PSAT and SAT for grades 9 and 10, and then not.
Such as the Iowa assessment, PSAT and SAT, or something like that. Everybody all right with that?
Yeah, perfect. Thank you.
Yep. And then, so it would, you want to read it back to everybody what it would say? It's a
just
a set up nationally.
Immediately remove the Florida Standard Assessment, FSA, and replace it with a set of national norm reference tests, such as the Iowa Assessment for grades 3 through 8 and the PSAT for grades 9 and the SAT for grade 10. Just a couple words.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. Everybody comfortable with that?
Yep. And the only thing I said this last time, and I feel strongly, so I'm repeating it again. I think that the section on mandates should just require, say, please, no more mandates. This is giving them permission to give us mandates, and when we say, go ahead, give us mandates, fully fund them, they're going to give us mandates, and they're not going to fund them. So we should just say what we mean, which is please no more funding. Here it says to fully fund any new mandate, and then you further say, you know, when you give them to us, give us a year to implement them. That's not telling them you don't want mandates. That's saying it's okay to give us mandates, but fund them and give us time to implement. And I personally think that that sends the wrong message for all the reasons listed after that. But, you know, I've said that before, and I guess that was not of concern to the rest of the board, but I just feel that we're, this is useless.
I would disagree with the second part of that, because I think it is important. I really do. And that's what this session is about, is making any adjustments that you want to have here. And I don't disagree. I mean, I actually agree that we don't want any more mandates unless we fund. And we do need a year's lead time. Is that all you want said? That's good to me.
I think it's more effective. I understand what you're saying, Claudia. I disagree a little bit. I think it's more effective this way. I think to just say, no more mandates. Well, it might be something that actually needs to be done. I mean, God knows what that is, but...
But it needs to be funded.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think to legislative body, I think that would be more effective to say, if there's any mandates, you know, and have these conditions with them, other than just say, no more mandates.
And just as a follow-up, you know, the reason why I think that's important is because for years we've been asking for local control. Mm-hmm. We know our community. We know our needs. And these mandates from out on high have time and time again proven, look at FSA, they have proven to be, it's not educators and professionals that are coming up with these ideas. It's politicians with agendas. And so, to me, that goes in hand with local control, no mandates from on high, because that violates the local control in our community. So I think that reinforces the reason why we don't want mandates, because we know our community better than Tallahassee does, and every school district is different. So that's the other part of that, and as soon as we say, go ahead, fund them and give them to us, that continues to perpetuate their understanding that even though they're not education professionals, they know what's best for students, which they never have shown to know. So, but, you know, I understand where you're coming from, and, you know, whatever the board corporate decides they want is language, it's fine.
I think you have to decide, you have to step back and say, what is this and what are we trying to accomplish?
Right.
And, and it may accomplish absolutely focus. But I would assume it would have more meat, more successful language like it is, as opposed to just say no more mandates and that's it. I understand what you're saying. I get you. But we need some other thoughts on what to do with this.
What was our success rate last year with legislation?
You know, as you were speaking.
So, we don't agree a lot, but I like to agree with her occasionally.
You're
to
so
feel good.
But
maybe we need to just keep it simple. Let me write that. What was that word you used?
Magnificent.
I thought it was. I don't know what you call
that.
Maybe we need to keep it simple. But we may need to spoon feed it too.
So my experience, I did present to the legislative delegation in St. Lucie County last year, and my experience is you get 5 minutes at the microphone.
Yeah.
That's all you get. So we need to hit our points quick. So,
well, I had to do it in place of Karen one time, and it was...
Well, let's ask this question. Seeing what we have here, which ones of these... do you want presented aloud? Because they're going to get this whole thing handed to them.
You mean in what order?
No, not necessarily.
Do you want you to mount it on the microphone?
Well, maybe not in what order, but the ones that we've got 5 minutes. Which ones are the most important to us? The unfunded mandates, to me, is very important.
I think that's what's number one.
But then from there on down, you know, I wish they would give us the ability to vote our own tax increases in down here. And that if we had that ability to get that other half mil...
So that should be a priority.
Well, but the point being there, it would take it off their back if they said, well, you local districts, you decide. If you want to raise the taxes, you do it. And to me, I mean, it's bad raising taxes, but if we need the money, we ought to be responsible for it. So. But this one doesn't exactly say that in the you know, allowing 25 mils to use for operational needs. So
pretend you have a 60-second commercial in practice. Rolling it off.
It's more caps. But I think that I agree with the capital, the mandates, and also the excessive testing. Another talk for it. So pick your bullet points under those. We trust you.
You say you trust.
I'm being magnanimous now.
I have one that I'm concerned about.
Which one, Sean?
That's the eliminate the requirement that school districts must pay tuition and administrative fees to state colleges and universities for dual enrollment. I understand the origin, and it stings, but my concern would be, knowing these guys, they would just do away with dual enrollment, and there are a lot of students that really benefit from this. So, I know Mr. Searcy has his word, pre-K-12.
K-12.
Sorry, we're pre-K-12 now.
Third or second book now. Okay.
Second page, second book.
Whatever the board wants. This is basically the items that are going to be presented by the four counties, I believe. Mm-hmm. Basically.
I just wonder if there was any other concerns.
We just need to
how they might have
thought it. Yeah, I share your concern, but I think too many times we're so busy trying to preempt what we think that they're going to do that we don't say what we need to say. And then that empowers them more. You know, so I think that if we really believe that this is important, we need to put it out there. Because, you know, in the end, all we can do is use our voice. And trying to second guess them, you know, may shut our voices down. So I hear what you're saying, because that would be my tendency too, to think, you know, if we bring this up, they're going to say, okay, forget it. But on the other hand, if we don't say that it's a concern, because there's no reason why the state colleges and universities aren't funded for that, because they are higher education. We're using K-12 dollars to pay for higher education, mm-hmm. You know, and I think that's the crux of the issue. But I hear what you're saying. I think it's a 50-50. I want to leave it in because I want that to be heard, but there's everything has a risk. And I'm willing to personally, like as a person, say, let's take that risk. But you might say, and I understand it.
What do you want to see, Sean? I mean,
I would actually, it's good that you asked that because it makes me think, like, how would I frame this positively?
Okay.
I guess this might fall under the unfunded mandate piece of retroactively sort of creating a fund, or I guess there already is a funding mechanism in place, you know, it's mom and dad or the Pell Grant, or, I don't know, it's just... It's a good program and really benefits students, and that's where I'd like to start with it and move out from that.
Dale?
I really don't see the state eliminating the program, as you said, and I don't see them as picking up the tab. I think this will go on deaf ears. But I do, if you wanted to frame the question different, then it would be, instead of eliminate the requirement that school districts pay, then say, state should be responsible for tuitions
Via categorical
as for the staff
fully funded
fully funded or share. I mean, you might get or share, like, you know how you
right.
the state should fund or share in the tuition.
Who should share it? The state.
Right now, we're paying fully.
Right.
The school district.
Right.
The requirement, or the way this is worded, is that the school districts eliminate the requirement that school districts must pay for the tuition. Mm-hmm. So if the school district happens to force it, doesn't have to pay. We have to pay by statute, correct?
Yeah.
So it's a statute, so we're not eliminating the program. They would have to rewrite the statute. So my thing would be just to switch the payment to state should be responsible for the paying funding and or share the responsibility with the local. I mean, I prefer they do the whole thing. We know that's not going to happen. Maybe if we get lucky, they might share it. Because I don't think they're going to rewrite the statute.
So if I were to get a sit-down with these guys as part of a negotiating team, I would think that that might be one of the concessions for the point two, to return to point 2 million. Just say, okay, you want to do that, you want to give us all this nonsense, give us at least the opportunity to consider whether a community wants the funding. I mean, I know that that's more big picture than we're probably going to have in our 30 seconds at the podium with Debbie Mayfield, Senators, Nagron,
and
Altman.
And point two doesn't cover the tuition anyway, because it's not capital.
Right.
Chip were made at our meeting a couple of weeks ago. There's an interest because this is no cost to the student or the parent. And a couple of the comments that came up, well, let's make sure that the parents or the student have a chip in the game. Mm-hmm. That's a chip.
Mm-hmm.
Southernburg, Northern Group.
How do you...
But they don't have anything in the game, and they don't have anything to lose. We lose everything, and I think there would be more interest if the student, especially the student, had to buy in, to buy the books, to you know, pay part of the tuition, whatever. Anyway.
I agree, but for the statute, we can't make that happen.
Excuse me?
For the statute, we can't make that happen, right?
Yeah, we're appealing to the legislative delegation to make some changes.
So,
right.
So you're saying eliminate that we pay it, or
suggest that they alter the statute to say that we don't have to pay for the books, or at least make the student pay something.
I hear what you're saying. I'm always cautious when it comes to starting to lay the burden on students. We see that with pay to play, because sometimes students, you know, we have 60% of our students on family use lunch, and sometimes we have that thing. For them, that's a hardship. And public education is predicated on access to all, and it's not always equal for all, because students have different needs. And with something like this, you could create a barrier for students that cannot afford to buy those books, because books are very expensive. So I hear what you're saying. I do believe in the same concept of when people have skin in the game, they follow through. But how do we do that cautiously without having unintended consequences for those students
And it's my concern as well. The argument, or not the argument, I guess it is an argument in the classical rhetorical sense that I've heard, is that the Pell Grant exists for those purposes. So students who do have income issues would have access to those funds up to, I think, like $12,000 or something like that. So, there again, I know we're kind of majoring in minors here. It was just this one thing. I know it's a good program, and it's a very complicated issue. And probably it may not even be in anyone else's top five, but it was something that stood out as a concern that program might disappear.
Seriously, need some kind of consensus here.
I'm gonna leave it in unless you all say no.
Okay,
Good.
Anything else on that? All right. Ms. Jimenez?
Yes. I just wanted to bring up the Cultural Arts Village. Have any of you heard of what they're doing? Okay. I see So I just brought this information to you because there is a group that is working on revitalizing that Edgewater neighborhood, and it's right near the Flick. So it's, I'll tell you where it is. It's the area between the railroad tracks, 20th Avenue and 20th Avenue, and State Route 60 and 18th Street. And what they're trying to do is create an area of where there's arts and there's small business, and it revitalizes that community. And the only reason why I bring it up is because the Freshman Learning Center is a part of that, would be a part of that cultural arts village. And I talked to Dr. Rendell just from the perspective of if one of our schools is going to be part of that neighborhood, if they move forward with this, it would be of interest to the school district to know what's going on and to see if there are any opportunities for partnerships. This is not a United Nations program. It's not a 750 program. It's not an all-board program. This is coming from the Cultural Council of Indian River County, and they've been meeting with members of the community and getting input. So I just brought it up. They're having a meeting September 12th to discuss what that is about and what it could look like. And then they're going to share, they're going to be working from September 13th to 17th, putting these suggestions from the community into a plan. And then on September 18th, they will do a presentation of what that plan would look like. So I just brought that in as an awareness. And so the board members know this is happening, and so the superintendent is aware, and maybe the school district can be just can participate, the eyes and ears, and hear what's going on, since we have schools and families in that community. So that was my
little. I got a question. What? What are they talking about doing?
They're talking about.
In Reader's Digest condensed version. Is this?
Basically, that's a community that tends to be a little sketchy. They're trying to revitalize it. And you know where 14th Avenue is, and they have the gallery stroll every Friday night? That since they started doing that, there have been a lot of new restaurants coming in. There are a lot of more galleries coming in. And so they're trying to create an arts village and encourage artists to be there, encourage more businesses to open up, and create opportunities to make that a healthier neighborhood.
Okay. Here's no. Go ahead, Deb.
It should try to get a CRA.
That's I think the direction.
And so that's the direction.
Can you tell us what a CRA is?
Community redevelopment. And what happens is the county will refund part of their taxes back into.
That's what we need.
Do you live in?
No.
His office is there.
I know. But that's part of like a system. They have a CRA district for about 10 years, and they'll take money. Like if somebody in art business wanted to, I'm thinking that really nice. Let's say that I want to say the Victorian Hill building, some arts building, where that old whatever it was, the brick building that nobody can do next to the railroad tracks. So if somebody wanted to open a business,
It was a power plant.
Okay. So if somebody wanted to open a brewery there, let's say, and in that building, which I think that's like, but anyway, it looks like a brewery.
It does.
But they would carve out that on the map, and then they would have 10 years to take that tax goes into a fund, and then they create a committee. So if there was a bunch of artists, they would pay their taxes. That money goes back in, and then they would maybe beautify the sidewalk and do that. So. That might be where they're going with that, because it's kind of expands the area that's out of reach with that the niceties of the stroll, as you're saying, which is nice. And I'm sure something maybe the art division of whatever. It would be nice that they know.
Right. So I shared with Ms. Menes today that I've talked with Ms. Kuntz about projects in the community, so I wasn't aware of this, but I'll talk with her again about if there's some art shows or there's some ways maybe the kids can have their art displayed or partner with the group. We'll work on that.
Cool. Ms. Simchek.
Thank you. I talked to Dr. Randell, and I think that I'll take a guess that most of us was called over to the ARC, and there was a particular parent whose child had timed out in age, I'll say, and they went through transition and at 22 was out. And there was a discussion on what the ARC does for the community as well as the ESC and what we do with as a whole, as a district. Of course, being called out of the district from members in the community, we get their perspective, what we're doing, what we're not doing, and of course, only from a small eye, what we were doing with perhaps maybe the Wabasa School, which where that student came from, not so much what we're doing with ESE. There was some talk, and then I met with them, and obviously we're getting a new superintendent. So it was really, we had discussed as a group corporately to wait till the new superintendent came in. When I get, and I don't know how the rest of you feel, but sometimes when I get called by the community to look at something or an issue, you start to investigate and they present, this isn't happening, this is happening, this isn't happening, and then you get back to, let's say, home base. We find out that, no, we really are doing this. No, we are sending out flyers about the filing for the aid. Apparently there's a 10-year waiting list to actually even get aid for ESE students, even for simple things like depends and some of those things. So it becomes financial burdens on the family. They're not aware that they can file for these papers. The kid transitions out, and then they have to pay for the daycare, and it just becomes a long process. So when I came back to the district, I found out that we are, and I'd seen a copy of the flyer that actually went out. So I thought that there was maybe some miscommunication. So the reason I brought it back was because we had discussed a little bit about this at another meeting and said we were all kind of concerned, but there was a lot of transition. There was a lot, between hiring and end of year and then letting Dr. Rendell get his feet wet. But I wouldn't want to task. What I would like to do is give Dr. Rendell the opportunity collectively to, address how we're doing this, specifically with transition, and are we doing everything? This is, again, what you just said, the Reader's Digest version of, this is what we're required to do, this is what we're doing and more, and this is what's going on. And obviously, we can, in every area of what we do things better. But there was, and I don't want to say an accusation, but there was a frustration from the public that we're not quite doing what we should be doing, could be doing, things are falling through the cracks. And I got back and asked some questions, and I didn't see it quite like that, but I did, I didn't get the full picture. We could get the full picture, and at this point, it also is a, it's in public view. We're all looking at it. And then if there are any things that could use improvement, Dr. Rendell sees that, he can at least tell us as a group so that we can at least address these entities that have mentioned this to me, and I'm guessing they pulled one or two or three of you aside to try to get over to ARC and see. And they may be the only game in town, they may not be. And as I said, I'm not sure what it is, but instead of trying to do all the research and then I would, I can't task Dr. Rendell. Well, what are we doing this? I'd rather not do that. I'd rather be like a collective front saying, how are we handling our ESE? The kids from 18 to 22 have to stay in school. And then they transition. At 22, they go out. And some of those benefits that are afforded to them for, I don't know if you call it disability and or what you call it, the actual benefits that are that allows them to go to daycare. All of a sudden, a kid gets 22, and what they were saying was they are now stuck with a child or a grown adult, severely handicapped, that can't even use the facilities or maybe eat on time and be alone, and they have no child care, and they're quitting their jobs. And in essence, they were actually saying, a part of it is because the school district is not hammering out these flyers and these letting us know our benefits way ahead of time, so with that 10-year clock, so I'm not sure. Somewhere in between, there's what we're doing, what we're not doing, and, at least being able to say, hey, we are doing this. This went out the minute they hit kindergarten. This goes out every report card. This goes out. So if that sounds, as I said, you would like to see that. That's why I brought it up.
Sean had his hand up first.
And we didn't get around to the student progression plan. I think this seems to be a pretty simple fix if we have something in the student progression plan about commencing transition services or making informed decisions or making information available. at the middle school level, if we start thinking about it at that point, and I know that there are IEPs, there are all sorts of federal things here, and I don't pretend to be the educator, but just from a procedural administrative standpoint, which I do kind of understand, that would seem to make sense, that if we just put that in the student progression plan and say, hey, the board has done its due diligence and that we have a policy in place. Mm-hmm. It's just a thought.
Got it.
Yeah, I kind of was thinking along those lines, so maybe it was good that we didn't get to the people progression plan today, because that would be a way of putting that in writing, because I know since we had that meeting with the parent and since most of us visited ARC, I know the school district, I've seen the work that they've done. I have gone to the meetings that, I can't remember who the person is now, I'm embarrassed to say, but we have a staff person who is part of a Treasure Coast group, and they do a fair for the parents, and they bring in programs, they bring in, it's Carmen Noonan, she's the parent liaison, and then there's a staff person. So I think that a lot of that work, because parents have spoken up, unfortunately, is being done. And I think the other piece of that that's important is that when you talk to, and this is one parent in particular, I think the frustration is that in the community, there are no places for these young people to go. So we can only do so much until they're 22, and it's more of what is our community doing to embrace these students, and it's very challenging, because I know in Fort Pierce, when the USDA lab opened, part of their contract, that's the U.S. Department of Agriculture lab, part of their contract was a commitment to hire some of these adults from a special facility, and it was at a cost to them. And when their contract expired, they were unable to renew it for financial reasons, because it was at a cost to them. It took more employees to get the service done. They were doing it to be of help, but the funding isn't there. And I think with our parents, there has to be they have to understand that the school district can only do so much, and what can the community do to embrace, provide jobs, and provide services? And that is beyond our control. And I think sometimes it's put on us that we are the ones, and we can't afford to provide those kind of services. And it's hard. I can't imagine being a parent. I know one parent, their child regressed because they learned all these skills and then they had nowhere to go, and over a period of time, the young adult lost a lot of the skills. But we have to distinguish that, because I worry they think we can do more than what we can actually do sometimes.
Yeah.
Do you sit on the economic board?
I do.
Because they have, if we can grab the Air Force Commission, they have the economic development, they have job grants in our county. And if the county would recognize that those adults, even though they have disabilities, are worthy of jobs, and they would be willing to offer business owners, and if they would be willing to participate in a job grant for disability, that would be a great thing to
do. I'll try, however, I will say this. Workforce, our career source now.
The
yes.
workforce. We've got millions sitting somewhere
that
doing
one point,
nothing.
1.2, yes.
Yeah, we could be using some of that.
That might be a good source of funding, because these jobs grants are typically for the higher earning jobs, so it would be difficult to say. It's not a bad idea. I don't disagree with the idea. I will say that the current model is they're more for your higher skilled roles. They're trying to attract like engineers to the community. But certainly a conversation I'm very comfortable having if that's the issue.
And additionally, I found out there's a goodwill where they're actually going over to the goodwill and helping out. Also, Dr. Rendell was mentioning looking into maybe part of the support service building had like a cafeteria area and teaching skills, and then perhaps maybe we could use adult ed money towards that. I'm not sure, but that's right. Why I said I was hoping I could discuss with my peers, say this is kind of what we're thinking, educate us. If there's any new ideas or if we're doing something good, let us know.
Correct. So
we can at least articulate to these.
So what I'm hearing is to put on my to-do list, Mustang, is to give you guys a report next time as to what we're doing with transition services, what have we done, what are we doing now, what's our plan for the future, that kind of thing. Because I did have a meeting with the parent that you all indicated earlier, Ms. Francis from Wabasso and Dr. Ferrantino scheduled for last week, the week before last, but we had to cancel it because we were preparing for Tropical Storm Erica. So that's been rescheduled to either next week or the week after. But either way, I can definitely give you guys a report on, you know, what kinds of things we are doing. Mm-hmm. Are we doing the things we're required to do? Are we doing anything more or less? What plans do we have for the future? Because I know Ms. Francis has some plans for some things at Wabasso that, you know, one of the first things she mentioned to me when I went there to visit back in June was, I need to have a better transition program for the students that are here. So that was one of her top priorities from the beginning. So, you know, I'll give you guys an update as to what we're doing. As far as the commercial kitchen that is at the Support Services Center, that was supposed to be used. The idea originally was we would train our cafeteria managers there. We're not using it for that. So that facility is vacant. We're not getting the best use out of that. So there has been a proposal in the past to have that be a place where we could train students in basic food prep so that maybe they could then get a job in that industry. So we're going to revisit that discussion, and I can bring you guys an update next time.
If it could be next time, that's fine. But since this was on the burner for months, if it wasn't next time, but the time after,
yeah,
that's fine.
As soon as we have something worth sharing, yeah.
2 weeks, give me a report, give us a report. But that's something I just want to make sure that everybody else was on the same page with me to get some information.
Just one little comment around that. And so as a follow-up, we're talking very specifically about Wabasso, but in general, to look at our ESC program and how we're doing it, so that could be part of your
work. Yep. Yeah, it's a comprehensive look. Okay. Yep.
Is that it on that? And Dale, I do apologize for having to step out during your item.
Oh, that's fine.
Trying to figure out who's picking up my kids. ECF going to be called on. Sean, do you have anything?
I'll table it.
What's that?
I'll take a lap.
All right. Mr. Searcy?
Take a lap. My idea here was the use it or lose it policy. You know, the press keeps hitting us pretty hard on bank days off. We right now have $9 million worth of bank days off. And I just would like to figure out, number one, what arrangements do we have to handle that budget-wise? Do we know how many each year are set to retire and have access to the funds they have put together? And I guess in the long run, is there any way that we can implement the use it or lose it policy for anybody starting after a certain date? I'm ready to put it in, but
So I brought some documents that we could pass out. These are it's actually information that we presented at the July 28th. I think we had a workshop on sick leave and vacation leave payouts and that kind of thing. And first thing you're getting is a bar graph that shows, I think the first one's vacation time payouts over the last several years. And you'll notice in the 14-15 school year, the payout was $223,000, $923,969. And then the sick time payout was $877,205. That sick leave buyout was actually, I don't want to say an anomaly, but we had a lot of heavy hitters retire last year, high salary dollars that we don't have on the list this year. We don't have anybody with that high a salary that's retiring that has that kind of bank of sick leave or everything. I think the third page you have was an indication that Dr. Fritz had taken a look at the last several years and what we have upcoming. It looks like a steady amount of people that are going to be retiring. So really, if you look at the first bar chart, you see that the 223 was fairly close to the 204. And then if you look, you know, it's a slight increase from the years previous to that. And then if you look at the sick time payout, it's fairly even until last year. You know, last year, like I said, we had some people retire that had banked a lot of sick leave, and you know, that was anomaly is probably not the best word, but that was more than normal. You know, that we would see. We do budget for this every year. It is in the budget terminal pay. We usually budget about $750,000, so $750,000. Last year, when you add the vacation and sick leave buyout, it was $1.2 million, so it was more. But again, we really feel like it's because of the heavy hitters that retired last year. Don't know what else to call them. But, so we budget for it. Is it something that we could take a look at in the future? It's almost all negotiated, so it's things we would have to negotiate.
But like we said early on, if the interest is there, you got to start somewhere.
Sir?
We can't go back and say, okay, all you guys started 30 years ago.
Correct.
But at some point, it looks to me like, this is the standpoint, we need to look at it. We need to look. I don't know what other districts are doing around the state. I don't want to compare us to anybody else, but we need to be fiscally sound here. And that's the reason for bringing it up. And it seems to be a growing concern in every government
right.
agency.
This comes up every few years. We did this a few years ago. It was real heavy in the press and things like that. And we actually, there were some policy changes made with, what was it, Suzanne? There were some policy changes made with Ivan.
There were some buyback provisions added in.
Some buyback, just trying to do some stuff there.
Right.
I know, and with that time, we had some comparative data with districts around us and also with districts our like size. So it's one of those things, and it does get kind of, like you said, people who have been here a while, because if they recruit them before this date, August 13th of 1982, whatever the hell it was, you know, then you play by this set of rules, then you play by this set of rules, and it gives you a headache. But no, it's something we can definitely look at.
But that's a common answer that we get. Well, we looked at it a couple years ago, but we didn't do anything.
Right.
Maybe we did do something.
Yeah,
but the only way that it's going to work, in my way of thinking, right here, is if we have Indian River, St. Lucie, Martin, maybe Okeechobee singing on the same page.
Well, we're one of the few districts that does do the sick leave buyback over the summer. Not all surrounding districts do that. And that is an incentive to not take the sick days during the year and then sell them in the summer, and we're not paying them out at the end. So we are one of the few districts. That's a proactive approach. That's a way to try to avoid the heavy hit later. We do have caps on vacation days, at least for administrators, I know, and that kind of thing. So, you know, I'll ask Dr. Fritz to give me a rundown on everything. Perhaps he can come back to one of the other meetings again and give you, because some of it's state statute, some of the things we are bound to, we can't do this or that because it's state statute. But anywhere where it's policy or negotiated, you know, those are things we can address.
Well, and I'm one person. I don't know what these
right.
other folks think, but I think it's something that needs to be addressed and not be in 2 years we'll say, well, you know, we talked about that. No offense, Mom.
No, my point was there were some changes made
yeah,
recently,
okay.
And but again, they had to be negotiated and stuff like that.
And that's part of the process. So. Okay.
Anyone else?
This is very common in government, and that's why you hear like tier one, tier two, tier three, tier four. I started it this year, and this is what I get. I started it that year, and that's very common. It becomes a little bit of a nightmare for HR to plug in certain ways to calculate, but it is mostly negotiated, and I am glad that you said starting after.
Yeah.
To being proactive and to look out for the healthiness, we have to keep in mind, you know, that like FMLA is 12 weeks, right? So the person should be able to at least, and I don't, you know, again, not knowing numbers, at least be able to keep 12 weeks on the book. That might be part of the statute. I'm not sure. But I do agree, and I just to be quick, I agree that, you know, you can't touch people who... gentleman has prostate and he's saved all his sick time and now he's fighting, battling cancer, and we didn't use it or lose it and he lost that. They were a great employee. But when somebody starts an appointment with the expectation of this, I totally agree. We could look at it and obviously it has to be bargained, but I would be very much willing to look at that. And you have to create that those tiers that you need.
Well, and is it okay for me to...
Oh, yeah.
Well, the other issue on that, the heavy hitters that Dell spoke about weren't heavy hitters when they started. But whenever they finished up, they were heavy hitters and it's a big pay rate. So those starters become heavy hitters, and that's a drain to the district.
I personally would like to see the information, but I think it's interesting that when we talk about this, we're talking about the heavy hitters that are the people with the high salaries. and it's important to realize the impact that it has on the non-heavy hitters that are people that also work hard, and that's part of their benefit. And we've been seeing a deterioration of benefits, and it makes it harder to attract people, you know, to these jobs. So I'm happy to look at the data because we need to look at the data, but I think we have to be mindful that benefits are part of the appeal to these packages. And when you just cut away at benefits at some point, it's going to be detrimental to the organization to get quality employees. So I think there has to be a balance. But I, of course, support any information that we can get so we can make a good decision is always welcome. So I would support it. Mr. Searcy.
I'm good.
Okay. We're here till 4, and I do know that there is one item on the superintendent's agenda that we want to make sure we get to. So just as we're discussing, be mindful of that. Claudia?
I just wanted, mine are actually linked, just an update on the DSEG order, what's going on with that, and that's tied to the school line baseline data in terms of demographics and expulsion, suspension, and so forth. So this should be a quickie, I think.
So I had an initial conversation with Tony Brown about the board's desire to visit unitary status and achieving unitary status and that kind of thing. So he and I had a good conversation. We talked about setting up a meeting with all the stakeholders involved, review the data that shows where we are right now in relation to are we meeting all the different tenets of the desegregation order, and if we are, great. If we're not, what are we doing to address the ones that we aren't? So we started the process with dialogue. Next thing we'll do will be to gather some data and set up a meeting. So nothing concrete for you except that we started the ball rolling.
Okay. And when will we see some baseline data?
So the baseline data, not just for that, is probably your first meeting in October. I'll bring you some attendance data and some suspension and suspension and referral data to see how we're doing this year in the first 6 weeks compared to how we're doing the last 2 years. In the first 6 weeks. So we should be able to see some data about those types of things. We're putting together a benchmark analysis of the last few years to see how we're doing with benchmark data because we don't have FSA and we're not sure how reliable FSA is. So we've turned our attention to baseline data on benchmark assessments that we've created. Not most reliable, but maybe more reliable than FSA. So again, probably the first meeting in October or the second one for the achievement data.
Can you just include in that? That just would be just refining that file, and I can always make a plan of that. Your files had it, where it had the actual attendance ratios of each school, and where we had gone over that. Most of the schools we met that ratio that's required.
It's the equity report.
Oh, back, yeah, for that, yeah. Yeah, we have that.
Yeah, if you could just throw that, that should just be a pull of a file. If you could keep that all together, it gives a snapshot.
Is that the demographics
data
you're talking about?
Yes, that show each school, and where I want to say if we had to meet between 9 and 17%, and it showed where on each school we were meeting that.
Yeah, I know exactly the data.
Dale, do you have anything else?
Yeah.
Sean?
Just real quick, where we are with the testing thing, I've had a conversation with a couple of legislators, and some support it. Some in the House were helpful in helping me understand some of the political issues surrounding whether we can get this through or not. Say much more than that. There's also a perception that perhaps now that this has become a Senate-backed initiative, so the House may view it as not as attractive. So that's, and there is another meeting this Thursday night. Erica Donald is leading the workshop online. Sunshine Solutions is how we call it. Tina Calderon, the chair of Seminole County, is co-chair. That's it, and it'll be an interesting session.
Right. Chuck Rendell, I know you had an item.
I have two things, actually. One item on the agenda, another one just an information piece for everyone. I did meet with Mr. Waddell and the principal from the Indian River Charter High School about 2 weeks ago. They called and asked for a meeting, and the meeting was just for them to inform us that they will no longer be using a drug screening as part of their admission requirement. They are no longer going to require that, and they wanted us to inform us of that, and they were hoping that we would just take that information and leave it at that and move on and go forward. So I'm sharing that information with you as I was asked to do. But so they're going to amend all of their admissions paperwork to remove that paragraph, and they're no longer going to require that as part of their admissions. So, all right. The board did direct a few months ago, I believe, if they wanted information on the viability of an internal auditor and what that might look like, how much that might cost. And so I did task Mr. Morrison with coming up with a few models, and what he's done is provided me with two, or provided you with two. So what you have in front of you is a memo from him basically outlining two proposals. One, an internal auditor, how much that would cost, that kind of thing. And one, an audit committee that answers to the board as well. The first one, option A, the internal auditor, the information you have there is from Martin County. They do have an internal auditor and have had for several years. So those are the costs associated with having an internal auditor. That auditor would, in the model in Martin County, if you turn to your third page, I believe, it's an organizational chart, and you can see that the auditor does report directly to the board, so acts at the direction of the board. Mr. Morrison did a really good job of, on page two, showing you some pros and cons. So the pros of the option A are listed in the middle of the page where it says school board employee, pros and cons. So the pros, relatively stable fixed cost. In other words, you decide how much you're going to pay for your auditor, and that's basically going to be the cost year after year after year. They can do the internal accounts audit. They can do any kind of ad hoc or as needed investigation or audit. And you know, they can respond hopefully quickly because they are under payroll and would be able to move swiftly. The cons is you have to set the structure, you know, for them to receive instructions. If that person were to leave or to be terminated, there'd be costs associated with that. So that's with any employee. The second option, option B, is to have an auditing firm that answers to an audit committee. And we actually had that in place several years ago. If you go back to, I think it's your fourth page. No, actually much further. Sorry, your second to last page. There's an organizational chart from Indian River County years ago where we had the audit committee, who then contracted with an audit firm. And so the costs typically are lower with that because you're really asking for as needed work. But that means anytime you want to do something, you have to then set it up and contract with, you know, ask the audit committee to pursue that with the audit company and that kind of thing, so with the firm, and so you won't get turnaround as quickly, and you won't get necessarily constant regular auditing services. So he put together pros and cons, which is what you guys asked for. There is a job description there that is the Martin County internal auditor, and if we were directed, we would, you know, pursue creating a job description for an internal auditor here and that kind of thing. So just wait in some direction.
All right.
No, I thank Mr. Morrison for here, but I'm grateful for the information. Having seen this and having served on the board when we had an audit committee, my recommendation for our board members would be to consider having an audit committee where each board member has a representative that is part of that committee, where board members will have an opportunity through their representative to bring forth any issues of concern so that they can be audited, if that's the direction. I think that for the board to have someone that they have responsibility over, that the corporate structure would be complicated, and I just think that it lends itself to possible unhealthy situations, and I wouldn't want, I wouldn't favor that. I mean, I think as it is, we have a superintendent, and we employ two people, the superintendent and our attorney. We evaluate our superintendent. We don't evaluate our board attorney. And then if we take a third person, are we going to evaluate that person? Or, you know, I just think it adds further complexity that we do not need. I think having citizens be participating in that is important, and we would still have input. And I think that it would be a healthier way to go. So just based on past experience with the audit committee, you know, anything the board wanted would be needed, they discussed it and took care of it. So that would be my feedback on that.
Anyone else?
Obviously, I'm not in favor of the committee. I think we need to figure out exactly what the charge would be, to charge, meaning what the responsibilities are going to be for this audit committee or audit person. One of the things that I didn't see, and this was a brief look at it, I didn't see what issues had been brought up, what savings had been made by the audit person in Martin County, but I would be very interested to see that.
Okay.
If they can put a dollar amount on it, and this may be a full time position for a brief period of time. We may have somebody come in here and look at every issue surrounding the finances of our district. We may hit some home runs. We may hit some snags that we are not counting on. And they may be here for 2 years and may be gone. But I think that the individual is better. One of the things that I hear about government agencies, churches, let's form a committee. Well, Claudia and I may agree on a lot of things. This is one that I don't agree on the committee. We need to have somebody, their mission is to make sure that the funds that we have in the school district are handled properly, and that there's no unusual situations going on that we don't know about, because I would venture to say that none of us know what goes on in Carter's office today. We get the reports, I'm not picking on Carter, I'm just saying we don't know. And I just think that it's good to have that oversight. The buck stops with us. So I think it's good to have an individual as opposed to a committee. We do have one employee, or actually two employees, Judy and our attorney. And I think this board will be smart enough to figure out a way to review both the attorney and the auditor. If they're doing a good job, if not, can move on.
Yeah.
I'm going to straddle in between both of you. I picked up some of your good points. I definitely would agree with Ms. Menace that the chain of command and org chart, it just, I don't see it as a full time job. And I'm not crazy about the committee, because will they have buy-in? Sometimes you can't get somebody to fill in a committee for your district. Do they have the right qualifications? But I do feel if our fiscal year ends June 30th, that Carter's books may be closed by July 30th. I'm not sure. This would be Matt's idea. I mean, Matt knows what I'm talking about when I say this. So if you had somebody hired, subcontracted for 90 days to go through the books as a subcontractor without benefits and retirement and medical, and a subcontractor that answered directly to the board for that period when the books were closed, go through the previous fiscal year's finances and see if everything was up to snuff and make sure we're not repeating. That's early enough in the year to catch any mistakes from last year and say, discontinue. And this way we're only subcontracting somebody for 60, 90 days. Actually, if they're professionals, 60 should do it. But and report back to us their findings. And then they go off about their business for the rest of the year, and then it's really after year end
when Carter has closed his books and his finances are then, you know, they're obviously audited by probably the same guy that does everybody around here.
No, we're audited by the state of Florida.
So,
all right, so
then we, somebody such as the, a local firm can come in and do, instead of one, and it'd probably be one person from that firm, but come in for a short period of time.
I mean, the AGO does a full audit at the end of every year. Not a compilation, it's not a review, it is an audit.
Tell us what AGO stands for.
Auditor General's Office. Or the state of Florida.
You know, but this is where I think that I understand what you're saying, Matt, but that would be to make sure that we are complying with financial state statutes and things like that. But I think Mr. Susie was more looking at a more watchful eye on actual building projects, and that although through state statute, the Auditor General might say, okay, you did fine on that, but they may not be looking our purpose, and that would be part of the scope of the job that we have to create, that we are looking for any savings. I'll give you an example. I won't name specific vendors, but we had, I want to make sure I articulate this right, where we went back and audited, and they overbilled us, and we had within our policy that we would fine them so much money, and then we decided we wouldn't do that, and you know, it just, that's where I feel that we, and then we rehired the guy and gal or whoever. So I just, you know, saying I think what you're saying, Matt, is that person, make sure we're following state statutes and everything, but you're looking for specific cost savings,
right,
advantages, two different kind of
things. Yeah,
so it's the scope of job,
exactly,
that we're looking for.
Because yeah, I mean, are you looking at somebody for purely financial purposes, that would make more sense, because you know, we already have a financial audit. But you know, you'd have to just wonder, would, you know, hopefully this person would recoup the cost.
That's
the dynamic
question.
Is if it recoups the cost and pays for itself, by all means. The audit committee, as it was formed years ago, was, it seemed, this is, I mean, I'm kind of going off my own recollection, but a lot of the things that they were charged with that they did were important. I don't mean not important, but almost like, you know, for the public's benefit, meaning things like construction contracts. You know, there was a big, you know, all the same two construction companies hit everyone. You know, the process is rigged. It's a good old boys network. Okay. Have the audit committee look at the whole construction contracting purposes, and they did that. It wasn't necessarily a financial audit, it was more of a process and supply. And it was that kind of thing. So I don't know, I'm rambling, but if you want to go down this road, we have to define what the role is.
That's what I said early on. We have to get what the charge is.
Sean?
I've actually had the opportunity to speak with different school board members around the state, and Escambia in particular. He sent me a link that I'll share with you guys. For his general, his audit, the board's audit, he actually has, he's internal, but they save over $200,000 a year. And he shows things like our charters paying for all their lunches and things like that. So just those things that the GAO may not catch, to Matt's point, it's more of a procedural thing, and something like the sick days thing, they might come in and look at and make sure that everyone's numbers match up. I guess they probably do that in the Auditor General's too.
Is it a full-time?
His is. However, the consensus from around the state was that the model that seems to work best was the committee model, because then there are some advantages to having fixed and known costs, but there are also advantages. The two that I talked with felt the advantage that they saw was, one, you know, they're sort of philosophically against their own government and government jobs. But two, they become a variable and controllable cost, and therefore, as you get towards the end of the year and you run out of money, you can say, hey, let's throttle back. Maybe we don't need to do that this year. So that was the wisdom in the committee model that we heard. But it's, and I'll get their data as far as the savings. That's that's out there.
That's critical. That's
absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, we need to know that we're not just growing up.
Can I just make a suggestion? Not only while he's getting it, can we maybe next time, next discussion, just put that back on, and then we bring what we think, you know, either out of you or anybody, and bring back what we think that scope of the job should be. You know, bring back five good ideas, you know, what you're thinking that person might cover, because we might have different thoughts, and so we can kind of channel what we really envision.
And we'll probably have some information from Martin County on what kind of savings they had. But Escambia County, that's another good thing. But, you know, it's just, you know, it's not trusting somebody. It's the fact that we are responsible for every penny that's spent in this district. We are responsible. Something happens out there, it comes back to us. So you just, you know, make sure things go say.
There we go.
That
the
GRE.
Oh, there you
go. Yeah.
What was that other word we used?
Another concern the school board members had about it being a direct report situation is not just the coordination piece of it, but also the concern that that person lives in the district and might go native. Is
go what?
Go native. Basically, they form relationships, and they basically become a district employee that doesn't necessarily have as much of a objective viewpoint. By, you know, I mean, it's just the nature of human nature that we're around people who like them, and suddenly they're covering this report for someone, and then there's another report, and then pretty soon they're just another staff member in the accounting office, whereas that sort of defeats the whole purpose of a watchdog.
It's sort of like you have an IA.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, internal affairs, and it's that person is ostracized usually because of the nature of their work, and we don't want to create that. I mean, you know, we want somebody to really watch.
Anybody else have anything?
I did, and the superintendent may come back to it, but you know, we keep giving you this long list of things to do, and will you be giving us a report on what we asked you to do last week or this week? Or?
Yeah, we had the to-do list to share with you at the end of last time when we met, and we didn't get to it. This time we didn't have it, but we'll have it next time. We've checked most of the things off the list. So.
Well, I know, I would bet you had, but it's... If we keep adding to the list, I don't think we need to do that. But.
Okay. Got it.
Yeah, I just have one board report. I with your alternate at the Economic Development Council meeting, and what you brought up about salaries was very apropos, because if the board is interested, Ms. Stan can make a copy for you. But they gave us the data for the report card that they did for the average annual wage, and you know, confirmed what you said. Their focus is those highest wages, and even though that is their focus, I took a moment to speak up for the average worker in this community and people in this community that need a living wage. And I think that just because that's all they think about, it doesn't have to be that way if people speak up and advocate, because these high wage earners are not going to want to come to communities that are economically depressed, where the workers are living in substandard conditions. So what you said was right on, but I see it also as an opportunity to bring awareness to the fact that that's not the only thing that matters in our community, that the wealthy get wealthier and that we just attract wealthy people, because that's not who Indian River County is. You know, that's only a certain percentage. And as we know, we have such a tremendous disparity. Last year, we were number one in the country in terms of disparity between rich and poor. And that should be something that there's awareness around. On that day, there was also a presentation by a company that wants to relocate here. They're called Algae to Omega. And so we had a long presentation. And then for those of you who are interested, I only got one of these, but they showcased their new business card. And it actually, it's closed, but you can pull this out, and it's a little thumb drive to get all kinds of data for Indian River County.
So they've got these, and you know, I'll just leave this in our office if any of you want to look at them. And if any of you would like a copy of this, just let Mrs. Stang know. But it was a really informative meeting.
Anything else? Other committee reports, anything like that? Dr. McGill, you have anything else?
I'm good.
All right. In that case, we will go ahead and stand adjourned.
Till 5:01?
Till 5, yeah.
4.
4 o'clock. Executive session.
I'm sorry.
4. Yes. In the superintendent's conference.
I thought it got canceled, I saw.
And then it was reinstated.
You got to stay out.